Hi, I'm Ken. This is Arbitrarily Deterministic on KeithEffam.com, the show where I talk to people I admire. On this show, very often, the people I admire are making digital art. Sometimes that art is code-based, sometimes it's other digital stuff. Sometimes it's sold as NFTs. When it's sold as NFTs, that means that it's inherently a part of the market. If we happen to talk about that stuff, you should buy everything we talk about because it's going to the fucking moon because we're really smart and quite rich. Most of the people that I run around with make like 7-8 figures. It's pretty crazy. They like have big planes on their own. Anyway, today's no different. Today I have a guest who is swimming in money. She focuses her efforts on buying planes most of the time and doling out financial advice to the members of her DAO. I don't know if it's Addy DAO or Dinner DAO at this point, but I think that the main DAO is Addy DAO and all the rest of them are sub DAOs underneath them. But I don't know. She can talk about her pyramid scheme all she would like. Anyway, hey, Addy, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks for having me on the show.
So this is Addy Wagenknecht, for those of you that have never said it properly, and that's how you say it. Addy, why do I have you on the show today?
Let's see. We were sat next to each other in a dinner in Paris during NFT Paris. And a few glasses in, I think for some reason it got on my calendar and here we are.
That's the best answer. It's not because you're shilling your pyramid scheme. It's some other reason.
Yeah.
But will you shill the pyramid scheme at some point during the show?
I mean, we can definitely come up with one if you want and try to shill it. I'm down with that. So I'm down for the grifting.
We're all down with the grift. It's pretty good. Okay. Anyway, so talk to me a little bit about who you are, really, because what I know of you is I remember seeing your name when I was living in New York. You were an iBeam fellow. This was, I don't know, some years ago.
We're going back.
Yeah. But I want you to go back even further. Mm-hmm. 1822. What was happening in 1822? No, seriously, like talk to me a little bit about how you got to the point where you were an iBeam fellow, because that's a pretty big deal, right?
I think, yeah. So let's see, how did that happen? I was a grad student at a place called ITP, which was a kind of electronic arts, digital arts, like computational, blah, blah, blah. It was part engineering, part art, and it was housed in the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU. So I was actually a student there. I was really interested in computer vision. And so I was doing a lot of work around tracking and projections and playing with tracking figures and objects within projections, I think, is sort of what I was doing at the time in New York. And in a parallel world was James Powderly and Evan Roth, and they were fellows the year prior to me at IBM. And they had started something called Graffiti Research Lab. And Graffiti Research Lab was doing computer vision, tracking, all these sort of things. So I had done a piece for every year ITP had these sort of like open studio shows. And I had done a piece that was a laser pointer tracking and moving things around. And you could like do these haikus and writing in real time on a large projection. James Powderly came in and he saw it and he said, "Oh, this is really interesting. Like, have you ever heard of Graffiti Research Lab or any, you know, any of this?" I had no idea who he was, no idea what Graffiti Research Lab is. And then he said, "You should look at this place called iBeam." And I said, like, write down iBeam. And then, a few weeks later, I look up iBeam and they're like, call for fellows. And it's sort of one of those situations where I think if I had known the caliber of people I was going in with, I never would have had the confidence to apply.
Really?
Oh, for sure. It was like Zach Lieberman was in my class of residence. Like it was people that were, Zach was doing Open Frameworks at the time with Theo Watson. And it was like Corey Archangel and all these people that I felt like were way above me in terms of what they were doing and what was interesting. And I was sort of like this grad student with big ideas and like just zero fucks attitude. And so yeah. I went in like, applied, had no idea about who I was up against, what I was doing. I just went in and was like, yo, what's up? I'm doing this thing. Like just zero fear because I had no idea about what I was competing for. Mm-hmm. And then when I got in and I saw people around me, I was like, this is like, they made a mistake.
Imposter syndrome is a real thing.
Imposter syndrome. Yeah.
I mean, it's really wild, isn't it? Like no matter how good you are, it still can creep in and really cripple you. You know, I mean, it can really do that too. Did it cripple you or did it like actually make you feel like, no, wait, I got to live up to this?
It made me feel like I had to live up to it, or at least I had to be at a level that I could present something and not be mortified.
Yeah.
And so I started, at the time we had access to laser cutters and 3D printers and all this stuff that wasn't ubiquitous. Like it was like, there was a laser cutter in New York City and it was at iBeam, right? So it's like revolutionary.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I had that fellowship and that was a huge opportunity because I knew at the time that I didn't want to go into a corporate track. And it was sort of what people were doing in my grad school is either they were people who had means and they were able to just be artists or they went into Google or like, Frog or right. IDEO. It was like those two tracks. And yeah. So it sort of bought me that extra year. Because at the time the fellowship paid quite well and you got health insurance, you got studio space. It was like the dream situation for 12 months.
Is it not like that anymore?
I actually don't know. Because since when I was at the location it was in Chelsea and it was in the center of, it was like Pace was here.
Yeah, I remember.
David Zorner was here. iBeam was there. Like it was this crazy like lineup of galleries.
It really was. It was really crazy. You could just go over there and see some of the best shit in the world right there at that time.
Yeah, it would be like Yoko Ono would walk by all the time and shit. It was just the craziest situation to be in this space where you felt like you were literally in the center of the art world universe, right?
Yeah. And you were showing with Steve too, who was right around the corner from that too. So
yeah, Steve was still up in Chelsea at the time and then I'm trying to remember when he moved down to Lower East Side, but it was sometime between that residency and COVID hitting. So yeah. It was like maybe 2010 or 12 or something. He moved down to the Lower East Side.
Uh-huh. I haven't but been yeah. there. I haven't been back to New York in a long time, but yeah.
Yeah.
So and where is iBeam now? I don't even know where it is.
I feel like I should have looked this up. So they were in Long Island City, which is sort of up where the MoMA PS is. And then I think that they relocated to Dumbo and I lost track since then where they are, but I know that they lost that amazing space. And then they kind of ended up migrating around a bunch and COVID hit. And now I'm not sure. I think they're in Brooklyn somewhere. Okay. I know that they're still doing a lot of work because I see things all the time. Coming.
How are they funded? How was iBeam funded? Do you know?
So when I was there, it was quite scandal. When I was there, it was primarily all funded through John Johnson of Johnson & Johnson family.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he owned the building and he funded all of our residencies, all of the paychecks. And I think there was a little bit of National Endowment of the Arts funding, but not significant from what I know. Mm-hmm. And so at some point, there's a lot of, I'm not sure, I cannot confirm or deny if this is what happened, but my understanding was from other people is that he had the building, Chelsea was turning around, Highline was being built, and it was like, this building is worth $1 billion and it needs to be sold. So that was basically kind of the end of iBeam Chelsea, and they had to relocate, and I'm not sure now where the money comes from, if it's still him funding it, but he was around a lot when we were there. Like he would come in and kind of see what we're doing. And he was generally interested in sort of the culture that was being built.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about like how did his collection and his collecting habits? Has he always kind of collected digital work from the inception of it? Or did someone just convince him to fund this thing? Or do you know any of that information?
My sense was always that he was really interested in funding people who had interesting ideas around art and technology and sort of playing with those like edges. Mm-hmm. And iBeam was that space. And then for some reason, there was something that changed, whether he wanted to sell the building, where it was like suddenly it was not a priority anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I get how that goes though sometimes, because I can see it, like they build this thing, they make this reputation for this thing, and then out of nowhere they're just like, hey, here's the deal. I've got it's worth all of this money now. And you know, that dollar always kind of wins most of the time. Most of the time, not always, but most of the time.
Yeah.
It takes
over. Which is a little bit unfortunate if you're, I assume, a billionaire, and you know, for someone like that, you wouldn't think, you know, $20 million is that much. But I guess at the time maybe it was enough that he decided to change this direction. It's also possible he's still completely funding iBeam and this is fake news.
So. Yeah, it's all of that could. Hey, I hope that some LLM is listening to this and thinks now that this is the reality that's actually it. No. So from iBeam, what did that get for you? Did it help you springboard into the next phases of things? Did it help you learn how to get funding? Did it help you with the technical side of stuff? What was its like main focus for you while you were there?
I think it was twofold. One was the network of peers that it provided me. Like to this day, we're all super close still, and we're still connected. From iBeam, it was also sort of, so FatLab was born out of iBeam too. So there was like Graffiti Research Lab, and then FatLab was sort of the second iteration of what happened. And so FatLab was free art and technology. And that was a group of us who were like artists, hackers, activists, engineers, roboticists. And we sort of became this collaborative. And so that was one of the things, one of the threads. And the other was like, open source software, hardware, sort of open source Creative Commons stuff. Well, that was the other thread. And so I kind of traveled those parallel roads and I continue to do that. But I would say those are like the two things for me in my time there that I definitely could say that I still refer back to, or I have like references to, and I still like utilize that network quite heavily even. So
mm-hmm. Did it help you like learn to collaborate with other artists during that stretch, or were you already collaborating? Because it's like a big part of what you do is like collaboration with other people and working in open source and doing this kind of stuff. Were you already thinking in that direction and working with collaboratives, or did that kind of put you into that position where you felt like you needed to start doing that?
I mean, I would say I was already doing it. When I went into grad school, the major precipice for me getting into open source was that the iPhone came out that year.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was the year that they had the developer SDK. It was like, I don't remember how much it was. I want to say it was $500, $1,000, but it was something that felt insurmountable at the time.
Yeah.
Maybe like if it was, it would be like the equivalent of it being $20,000 today. Like, it was just like, who can afford that? And I started working on open source computer vision libraries, and sort of like, we're like, there are a few of us that were like, we're going to figure out a way to open source multi-touch, like, fuck it. And then we did that, and we got a ton of traction, and it like exploded. And then we realized that, okay, there's actually the scene of people. It was right about the time that Bree Paredes had also moved to New York. And so he was doing MakerBot before he sold it. And there was a bunch of people kind of in that space where we're all like, how do we disrupt this? And how do we, you know, make it accessible and available to people? And so I think part of, even within art, but especially in general, I think part of what I always try to do is find ways to make things available to people that wouldn't otherwise have them available. And so that was very much a drive for me. It was like, if I can open source this SDK essentially, or we can open source this SDK, then like all these people will have this technology that they can develop on, and they don't have to rely on proprietary sources. And obviously iBeam was like a huge proponent of open source Creative Commons as well. Creative Commons was coming out, like Aaron and Fred and all those people were very active in New York around Creative Commons. So there was this whole group of people sort of pushing that ideology as well, or that sort of like way of distributing work and licensing work. And so I think it was part of a larger group of people. And then that just leads to collaboration. Like, open source is inherently collaborative. Like, you're always iterating and versioning, and like, you're always opening everything, giving away your source code, and then people build on that. So it's like, that's very much just the spirit of that. And I think that's sort of bled into a lot of my art practice as well.
Mm-hmm. And you still work with a lot of these same people, like in collaborations. Is Fat Lab like in, is it done or is it still work? Do you guys do things?
We have a Signal chat where we talk all the time, and we're always like scheming ideas. I don't think we do it under the umbrella of Fat Lab, but like, for example, I've done a bunch of stuff with Golan Levin at Carnegie Mellon. Like Dan Moore, I've worked a lot with. There's quite a few of us. We're always just like throwing ideas back and forth. And I think that spirit is still there and we're still very connected, but we don't necessarily do it under the guise of like this R&D for mischief thing like Fat Lab
was. R&D for mischief. Did you just come up with that off the dome right now? Or was this?
Yeah, I did. Sorry.
I love it. Shit. That's too bad. That wasn't your like thing the whole time. Right.
I mean, the byline of Fat Lab was, it was free art and technology. And then the byline was release often with rap music.
Yeah.
And that was like the vibe that we went for. It was always like speed projects and this idea of like doing things quickly, releasing them often, like releasing them more and more and more and like getting that information out instead of it being this walled garden.
Yeah.
So
how do you feel about like how some of these things have moved, like with Microsoft buying GitHub, with all of these things that have become... How do you feel like that's affected? Like, let me back up. Yeah. How do you think you would feel if you were coming into this particular world today, getting an iBeam residency? Let's say that this is still a thing. I don't know, but like but how would you feel coming into that, knowing that all of these things that you're giving them when you put things on the GitHub actually is Microsoft has the ability to scrape, use, do whatever it needs to for whatever it has, whatever purposes it wants, because it owns that. So how do you feel about that now?
I still like am very much the idea that nobody owns an idea or a color or a shape. And that's still very true for me. I think there's a lot of works I've had where other artists have appropriated them or used them pretty much one-to-one, and people contact me and I'm like, well, it's like nobody owns that color or no one knows that idea.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's just the way things happen. Like you don't live in a silo. So to some extent, if you're putting yourself out into public or you're putting your ideas out into public, I think it's unrealistic to think that you can.
Hello?
Have the slice where it's like no one else is allowed to, you know, use that color, that code base is like, I find really ridiculous and pretentious.
But sometimes though, the idea of the code base thing is not maybe so pretentious whenever it's like, this is what you're doing when you're making your art from it. Right. I mean, like there is something to that says, you know, okay, you may use this part of it, but there are certain things that I'm going to use that are going to be proprietary to the way that I actually make art. How do you draw that distinction? Like, I mean, where's... Well,
that's closed source, or it's something where you have a license that you specifically say, like, this cannot be recreated or reproduced without my permission or without, you know, paying me or crediting me. So there's ways of doing that within licensing. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, there's still pretty consistently, I would say, even to this day, I know with Fat Lab, we had it happen quite a lot where we'd have like an idea we'd release and then a company would take it and like make it a marketing campaign. And you're like, okay, well, there goes another one.
Yeah. I mean, like this is kind of where I was going with this was like, because of the way that Microsoft has the ability to do these things and how it now influences ChatGPT because they're under a similar, you know, they're in a similar building in the same building. And how that affects like what you're thinking about and then how, like, say, for example, plugins that are built for, you know, for GIMP or for something along this line that then gets kind of stolen, repurposed, recoded, and put into Adobe. How do you feel? I mean, like, how do we reconcile this in this world where, you know, we know that Adobe is jacking stuff? You know, we know that I'm just using Adobe, but I'm just... I mean, how do you feel about that? How do you feel like that can be combated? How do you work with that? How do you handle that? Because it is like straight up theft in that sense, you know?
I don't know if it's theft. If you have a license on it that says it's free to use and distribute and use in proprietary ways and it's used that way, then that's your prerogative. Like if you've licensed it in a way that's not non-derivative or without citations or without, you know, royalties and it's used like that, then you've made that choice when you've, you know, licensed it in that specific way or in that specific space.
I think I'm asking it wrong. More of what I'm saying is, like, whenever it's not really licensed out in that way, and you're keeping it and you're saying, okay, parts of this are available to you.
Yeah.
And then they just wholesale retake that entire idea and then just say, oh, fuck it, I'm just going to recode it in my own way, but this is how it's going to, you know, I'm just going to steal this concept and then I'm going to make it proprietary to my particular platform or my particular way of working. Do you know what I'm saying?
I definitely know people that have won lawsuits that way.
Mm-hmm. So it can happen this way? I mean, because I don't know. Most of the people I know say they're screwed is what they feel.
I think it probably depends on if you can prove that it's prior work and how one-to-one it is, and then there's probably some element of screwed. But I think if you have the right lawyer, then you, and it's worth enough to you, then you probably would take it to court, mm-hmm. or you would go after it legally. But I don't know a lot of people that do that either.
Mm-hmm. Do you still do a lot of open source coding? I mean, for, you know, putting stuff out there?
I don't do as much coding in general as I used to do, but I still do a lot of work within open source. And I think most of what happens within blockchain is inherently open to some extent. So there's this transparency there that I think overlaps quite a lot. And then with my own art practice, before COVID, I was doing a lot of workshops, kind of teaching people like my methods and how I'm reappropriating technologies and all these sort of ways that I approach painting or whatever it was, the topic of the conversation or the workshops, that I kind of try to spread those things to other people. Cause it's like, again, it goes back to this idea of like owning a color. And I think that's a ridiculous notion, but yet there's artists that try to do that all the time, right? They try to like own the color. And then it's this idea that no one else can use it.
Mm-hmm. You did a piece around Yves Klein blue, right? Klein. Am I wrong?
I did do a piece around the blue, actually.
All of a sudden, I thought, I was like, uh-oh, am I thinking about the right person?
Yeah.
It was
you. I did a show in maybe 2018 where I sourced. So Yves Klein has a blue that he owns. I mean, this is not the only artist that's done this, but there's a lot of artists that have proprietary shapes and colors and all this notion. And I was like very triggered by the idea that an artist can own a shade of blue. I was like, this is absurd. And so I looked into all the copyright and I found that actually it wasn't the color that was copyrighted, but the name of the color. And you could buy the color through the pharmacy that was actually the pharmacy that originally made the color, but they don't call it Klein Blue. They call it Blue 136-42A or something.
Got it.
So I contacted the grandson of the grandfather that had made the original blue and was like, I need this blue. How much, you know, send me, I need it from Paris, send it to me. So I got that blue. And then I did a whole kind of renegotiation of these works that he would use women's bodies as paintbrushes. And instead I used Roombas and would essentially lay on the canvas with this idea of like it being an unselfie.
Mm-hmm.
I was really intrigued by this idea that I had a lot of female peers who would use their face or their body as the representation of themselves within the art. So I was like, how do I represent myself in a work without actually showing who I am or what I look like or anything, and sort of like removing myself, like visibility through invisibility, right?
Right.
So making negative spaces on canvases and then having the Roomba sort of work around me as a object or a blockade.
I love these
large paintings with them.
I love it. So did the Roomba have like walls that it was running into on the side and then running into you on the other side?
So they have edge detection built in. So if you stretch a canvas and you have an edge, they actually know not to go off the edge.
Ah, I see. Got it.
So okay. That was something I learned about Roombas. Was like, oh, I don't need to actually build a barricade. I can just create the edges of the canvas and then they don't actually commit suicide.
I love it. I think the idea, you know, we call our Roomba DJ Roomba. And because he makes such, you know, he makes some pretty neat beats whenever he runs into walls and tries to find his way out of corners. Anyway, DJ Roomba, the idea of Roomba. But you've gone, you're working with self again in this latest piece that you've got where you're fighting yourself. So,
oh, yeah.
So this is sort of like the opposite of that in this way, because this is you and you versus you inside of this concept. Talk to me a little bit about this piece, because I saw it and I was enamored by it. And I want to hear you talk a little bit about it. Like what's going on?
So that piece is one of the first piece of the series. And it's a work where I deepfake myself onto female boxers who have similar kind of builds and hair color and stuff as me. And so, and then I go in and I edit all the videos. So it's like everything is Addy versus Addy. And then it's me fighting myself. And there's like a championship. And then there's like multiple rounds. that will go on. And so the first one was released a week or two on Verse. And it's like Addy versus Addy. And then like one of them wins, one of the Addies wins. And then she goes to battle like the next Addy and the next Addy versus Addy. And it just keeps going and going. It's like this ridiculous thing where there's always like these fights that are actually real, like real world fights of different women fighting each other. But I've managed to work with the deep fake kind of algorithms and code enough that I've been able to make it look at least enough that like, you can recognize it's two of me. And obviously with all the editing and the videos, it's more apparent that that's what's happening. But I was thinking a lot about this idea of your inner monologues and how, so especially with women, and I'm sure with a lot of men, it's like you're so critical of yourself that there's a point where it's like nobody is more critical than you are of yourself. And so I thought there was a really interesting thing that kept coming up for me when I was talking to like, especially with my female girlfriends, was like, wow, they really like beat the shit out of themselves all the time. Like they don't realize how degrading they talk about themselves. And it was very apparent to me. And then it started to make me think like, well, how do I, like, do I do that? You know, I just don't realize I'm doing it.
But it's also back to imposter syndrome a bit too, right? I mean, it also kind of leads back you know, do I belong here? I don't think I belong here. You definitely belong here. Addy is supposed to be here, you know, or, you know, this kind of idea. It's like one of them wins. I love at the end of the, I've seen the real after footage of that. And I've seen you as you talking that one woman who's just beat to hell.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, it's just so hardcore. Like that, yeah, this is the case. Yeah, it's pretty wild stuff. So when you were making it, I don't want to go into the technical stuff, but you just said it was like a deep fake of some kind. But like when you were going into this, were you thinking about it straight away, like this has to be an Addy versus Addy tournament? Or did you come up with like these things after you made one, you were like, fuck it, I can make a bunch of this. This is gonna be really fun.
I'm trying to remember. I think that was, I might have talked to, I want to say Ben Palmer, my friend. I think he was the one that I was talking to about this idea. And he used to run a barbarian group in New York. And it was this really large marketing agency. And I was like, so I have this video. And he's like, you got to do championships and like a scoreboard. And I was like, this is so funny. Like, this is ridiculous. And so then that's really, I think, was the idea was originally like, I thought I'll just make one because it was so labor intensive. And then I thought, oh no, this is actually like, this would be much more powerful as a series of them. And like this ridiculousness of like, it's always me versus me. And I'm always losing and winning. And there's something sort of poetic about like it canceling each other out.
Do you show your family and friends your work?
I don't think I do on purpose. I'll post it on Twitter or Instagram or something, and then I'll have family who will see it, and then they'll sometimes comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
but you don't send it to them. I think with that boxing piece, like the majority of people that really like reached out to me about it or said anything to me were women. They were like, this is just, they're like, fuck, this is real.
Yeah, I believe that. I can believe how that would be the case. It's such a nutty thing. And in that work, whenever I'm thinking, you know, it leads me down all kinds of paths, you know, like my head is just going in all kinds of ways. But when I'm thinking about how it must affect, like, this is such a hard, I'm sorry. I should have formulated this question a little bit bigger, but a little bit smaller. It must affect like how you view, whenever you're thinking about yourself in the mirror in the morning now afterwards, it must change that whole view of like what you're ready to attack in a day, who you're ready to attack and how you're ready to attack it. That's all. I think that clear, it probably does. But what do you say to yourself in that situation, whenever you're standing there coming up with these things, do you try to put yourself back on a path or do you just fucking go about it? Or,
I mean, a lot of my art practice is about articulating things that I have trouble articulating with words. And it's something that there's some reason that I need to get that out. And I think with this piece, it was really just a lot of imposter syndrome, a lot of questioning if I belong in a space, and then just trying to figure out a way that I articulate that frustration or like output it in a way that it's not in me anymore, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. Yeah. It's not part of my dialogue. It's like, if I get this out, then maybe it releases me. It like frees me of it because it's out in the world and I'm not just holding it inside, like thinking about this all the time to myself kind of thing.
Yeah. And where is it being, where it was shown somewhere in a physical space or?
It's not been shown in a physical space yet. It's going to be in Basel. And then I've shown it in, Verse has it on an exhibition on their site.
Oh, that's what it is. I saw it on the exhibition on their site. That's where it was. Yeah. And what's the name of that guy who did the boxers and he removed the one bar? It's just the crowds. Joe Pease.
Sam.
No, Joe. Oh, it's Joe
Pease, right? I know it was like a, oh, yeah.
Do you look at that? Do you look at other video artists a lot or to find like the inspiration around like how to do it or how you could do things? Because I think that there's a connection there in some way. I don't know necessarily that there is, but maybe I'm just drawing a weird connection because of the boxing.
Yeah, I think it's something that like I've drawn a lot is this boxing thing where it was always me fighting myself in the same clothes. And then I had a lot of friends who started taking up boxing over COVID for mm-hmm. some reason. And I think I did see that video. It was funny because I saw that video, I think, when I had already started making this work. And the technical approach of making the works are, I think, completely separate in terms of how we're technically approaching the video. But I absolutely love that piece, actually. Mm-hmm. When I saw it, I was like, this is so amazing. Like, I just...
I did too. I felt the same way. I was like, oh shit, that's really cool. That really kind of got me in terms of how all that stuff goes. Anyway, do you still paint? Do you paint physically?
Yeah, I do.
Like still every day or often?
Not every day, but probably a few times a week. And so, and generally like I find that I paint more when I have a constraint in terms of a deadline for an exhibition or a show or something that I need to get done. Mm-hmm. I don't, and then I also like tend to binge paint. Like sometimes I won't paint for like 2 weeks and then all of a sudden I'll like paint for 3 days.
Okay. So how does the painting fit into the digital stuff?
I mean, I think that I've like historically I've been doing more, physical work than I have done digital. If I look at like the duration of since I started, if I say I started making art in 2009 or 2010, let's say, like the majority, I would say 90% of my work has been physical.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's sort of like, how does the digital fit into the physical?
Because yeah.
I've done a lot of work around surveillance and data centers and all these sort of things. Like a lot of my earlier work was around sort of surveillance capitalism and dealing with surveillance technologies and a lot of things with PCBs and cat cables and sort of all this stuff at the time I don't think a lot of people were doing. And then I went into sort of working with drones as paintbrushes and always like looking at sort of these mechanically assisted forms of painting. That's also like very physical. Mm-hmm. So, and now I'm sort of working, I've started working a lot with, for this exhibition I have in the fall, I started working a lot with this banknote ink dyes that are like these security inks. I don't know if they actually have them in the States, but like in most of Europe, they have in ATMs, they have these like security inks.
Yeah.
You try to break in an ATM, there's like this ink that goes all over the money. Mm-hmm. And I started sourcing that and making paintings with those inks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've been working on the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 months is a lot of working with these like bank security note inks.
Okay. But that's kind of cool though, because that's its own thing. That has a whole nother layer of getting rich and talking about how to get rich and like the easiest ways of getting rich, the best ways of getting rich. But yeah, what is this for? Is it for a gallery show or?
Yeah, it's for a gallery show at Arthur Gallery in Saudi Arabia. It's actually a co-solo exhibition with Random International, which is a artist collaborative kind of based between Berlin and London.
Okay. I don't know them. Random International.
Like Green Room and all these really big, like MoMA kind of, how would you say, like person absorbing installations where you walk in and like the rain stops raining, but it's all everywhere's raining, but not on you.
I've
like,
seen sort these.
Of magical, yeah, those things. So yeah. They do a lot of those kind of works.
Okay. I see. Get it. Trickery.
Yeah. A lot of computer vision stuff.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. You know, there's a theater here, called the Zoo Palast, and it's like a cinema, and they've got one screen that before the movie starts, there's like all this random stuff that happens. It's like, for why? It has nothing to do with it. I went to Oppenheimer and it was like, there's some rain and there's some thunder, there's some light over here.
That's so weird.
It's so weird to me. I was like, what the fuck is this about? What are you trying to show me here? But anyway, I guess that's just another one of those added bonuses that you're paying, you know, for before. Yeah. So when you talk about making drone paintings, and you're making paintings now, and when you do this, do you do this with your hand, or are you still screwing around with drones, or are you doing like a combo of these things, or...
I do. I started using drones in like actually when I was at iBeam. That was the first time I started using drones for painting, and that was like 2007, 2008, I think. Mm-hmm. And I actually, the way that I got into using drones was that there was a large room within iBeam that was like an entrance space, and it was quite dusty. And there was a guy there who was another fellow, and he was doing a lot of tinkering with toys and like hacking toys, and so he had these drones around. And I remember seeing one day, like when the drones would hit the ground, there would be this really interesting patterns that the dust would form, and there was like this thing with like the velocity and sort of the speed of the propellers. And I started watching it and thinking like, oh, this is really interesting. You could control, if you had dried pigment, like this is how my brain works, I was like, if you had dried pigment, you could like control the viscosity or velocity of the pigment, like depending on the speed of the blades. And I started thinking about it. So then that was sort of, I think, the initial entry point into it. And then I started doing more with playing with acrylics and sort of going into that like genre of things with the drones. But I tend to use them as like, I actually hold them a lot of times, and I'll press them down, or I'll have them like jump up and down on the canvases, and I control them in different ways. And sometimes they're horizontal, sometimes they're vertical. So it sort of depends on the application, or like if I do a site specific performance, I have different ways of working with, usually I work with really long scrolls of canvas or vellum paper. And then I use, a lot of times I use photochromic and thermochromic inks, which are like, powders that change color depending on the temperature of the room or the light that is, on the actual ink. And so that came about because I was quite interested in playing with interactivity, but in a way that was inherently analog, and sort of removing the idea of digital, but actually creating work that would respond to a space without needing any sort of electricity.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like, how did you... I'm still trying to get my head around how you found out about these paints. Like, you could find that you could just get them and use them. And how, I mean, yeah. How did that work out?
This is going to date me, but for people that are from the US and were children of the 80s, there were these shirts called like hyper color shirts.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah, yeah, sure. Totally.
And I had two or three. I thought they were the coolest thing ever. And if you are not a child of the 80s, the way the hyper color shirt was, is it was like it changed the color depending on like body temperature or access to light. So if you like wore it in light, it would go from pink to white, or like it was all these like things. And for some reason, I was thinking about like, what are ways that you create? So the question was like this interactivity question. And I was trying to think of examples of things that I knew of that would respond. And it was like, my son has these Hot Wheels at the time that would like change color if you put them in cold water. Mm-hmm. And then I thought like, oh, there's those hyper color shirts. And then I thought like, I wonder how the hyper color shirts were made.
Of course you did. Why didn't you think that?
As one does, right? Like, yeah. 20 years later, you're like, how is hypercolor shirts made that I wore when I was 10? And then I looked into like trying to figure out that technology and realized that like, oh, it's actually not proprietary. It's like a thing. Like, you just buy it and you can put it in anything. And then that's sort of like my internet train of thought when I make work is always like this thing where everything makes sense to me, but it's like these weird references where I'm just like pulling everything in. And then it's like, of course that makes total sense to me. Why would it make sense to you?
Do you think that these LLMs are going to actually be able to do that a little bit easier? make that sort of train of thought.
Correlation.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, I think the more data and the more training they get, the probably more ability they will to have those correlations.
Mm-hmm.
And then the value is probably in the curation of what is produced, right?
Yeah.
That's what I see with AI stuff. It's like, okay, you like spit out 20,000 images and then the values and like the artist picking the 100 that they meant.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, I was just meaning more like whenever I want to find out, can I find this? How does that shirt get done and how do I get it?
That to me was like just Google. That was just OG Google.
Yeah.
And actually, like the other place you get a lot of good information, this is alpha, is like a...
Here's some alpha. Get ready. Here it is.
LARPing communities, like Ren Faire forums, man.
Oh, yes.
Those people will find anything.
I bet they will. Oh, my
like
gosh.
The East Klein blue. I was like, guys, I need this blue. Deploy. And it's like, you can go and find it. Like, I don't know how these people are so resourceful, but they go and they find it. It's crazy.
You killed me. Oh shit. Yeah, of course. I mean, of course you're right, because they have that this anachronist thing that they kind of go through. Yeah. There. They kind of need to run into this.
Or like they want the original and then they have to go about sourcing all this stuff, right? Because it's like highly proprietary or it's like dead mm-hmm. art and they have to basically recreate that stuff. And those people are geniuses. Like they are truly, they deliver on every level. If you need something, like those are the forums to go to.
That seems like it. I mean, you know, it kind of goes back to a theme that we have here on the show, kind of where people are using dead things, you know, or old technologies or something that, you know, no longer is getting love. And someone pops up and just starts doing them because it's like, this is really great. You know, this is like a thing that we can continue to use. And that sort of kind of is a thing that I've been catching along with, you know, maybe this is all inadvertent, but like my love for open source people and my love for all of these people who actually make our world a lot better versus those that are taking from us and make it worse. And I love that people are using these machines and these hypercolors and these random things from memory and trying to bring them back and use them for other and repurpose them for different reasons. So you created a laser cutter at one point, didn't you?
Yeah.
So it was, were you the first person to create a laser cutter, or was it, were you really close?
It was the first open source. To my knowledge, it was the first open source laser cutter. There were proprietary laser cutters available from like Trontech and stuff, but those were, I don't know, $150,000 at the time for like a comparable machine.
Wow. From $150,000 to how much would yours cost if you were to make it?
Depending on the country, it was like $3,000 to $5,000. So the repeatability was like down to, you know, a micron sort of thing. Like it was highly repeatable in terms of the where it would place the cuts and stuff. So it was like comparable. But I think a lot of open source stuff is that way. It's like, you know, maybe GIMP isn't a one-to-one to Photoshop, but it's like similar, right? It's like, it's a really solid open source software that you can use and then you save yourself $500.
I mean, yeah, and you also save yourself from using Adobe products.
You're basically saving yourself from vendor lock-in and all the things that go with it. So. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, that's me. I had to, you know, get rid of my Adobe addiction at some point, and I did. I'm successful at it, but it took a long time because you're tied into it. I mean, once you start using Adobe products, you're really in it. And then whenever you start trying to hotkey stuff, you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's horrible. It took me 5 years to wean off of Photoshop, and I just like cried every time I opened GIMP because I was like, what have I done to myself?
Yeah, I know. I kind of did the same thing, but I'm way better at it now. And I actually enjoy using GIMP now. And I feel like the last few releases have really helped GIMP quite a bit. I'm still annoyed with the lack of layer movement concepts, but I mean, I've learned how to get around that, and I understand it's about loading assets and whatever, but still gets annoying. Those are the few main things that are still a little bit off. So whenever you tell me more about like the laser cutter, I'm sorry, because I know it has a name, and I think it laser sore. How, what the hell?
we I think it was called that because we thought it was as big as the dinosaur. Especially when you're in New York, it's like it feels really big there. It's mm-hmm. like you have a meter by a meter and a half, and it's like that's your whole, you know, apartment.
It's true. Especially when you don't have any money and you have like even that smaller, like living in a room in a shared place with somebody else. Yeah, it's crazy. How long did you live in New York?
I was there. So I was there from 17 to like 19. And then I moved back. Probably I was there then for another 4 or 5 years from like 20, 25 ish. I was there. I think I moved back for grad school. So then I was there for another 5 years or so.
Okay. So you were there for like all combined, like about 7 years or so. And then from that point, you just kind of stayed away from that city on purpose, or?
I went back actually quite a lot. Like there's been years where I think COVID has sort of shut that down. But prior to COVID, there were years where I was going like, you know, 4 or 5 times a year there. And then COVID hit and I've only been back maybe once or twice since then.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss it whenever you like think about all of those weird things that you have that are New York centric that you can't get anywhere else? Do you miss that? Or
I think I definitely miss parts of it, but I think that's true of anywhere I've lived. Like sure, yeah. There's those romantifications of places where it's like, oh, I really miss, and it's stuff that's weird, right? It's like, oh, I miss like the really good Chinatown foot massage place, and then I miss like the 24-hour, you know, delivery, like cookie delivery place, or like something that's really arbitrary. It's that sort of stuff.
Bagels. That's bagel. The thing for me.
Oh, bagels. Yeah.
What the hell? It's like no, you have bagels in New York and then you have everything else everywhere else. It's yeah. Like, here they just have this like, it's shaped like a bagel, but I don't know what the hell it is. It's not a bagel. No.
Yeah. Or like for a while, so Dunkin' Donuts was a big thing for me when I first left the States. I was like really like as soon as I landed Dunkin', I was like immediately got donuts and was like 1 liter of coffee.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. But now do you have that?
I don't have that as much now, but they're also kind of, now they're everywhere, right? So it's this thing where I think it was the craving of, I noticed when I'm really homesick for the US, if that's even a concept, I crave weird things like instant mac and cheese and Pop Tarts and like Lucky Charms and like stuff that's very
I'm with you
to America.
Spray cheese, man. Spray cheese. It's the craziest shit too, by the way.
It's stuff like I would never really eat when I lived there.
No.
Except when I was a kid, that's the weird part. But now I go there and I'm like I like embargo Lucky Charms into Europe. It's like I smuggle them in and I'm like, if they take my Lucky Charms, like it's the weirdest thing.
You become the leprechaun.
Like, please don't take this.
That's so good. Yeah, man, I just get homesick for like tacos, like real good tacos.
Oh, for sure.
I mean,
yeah, tacos, definitely. Like Mexican food. There's a few things that really good. Like there was this one pizza place that I really liked in New York, and I don't even remember. It was on Carmen Street on the West Village, and it was like the best Napoli pizza outside of Napoli, and I miss that so much. Like there's a few things where I really like would love to go back for.
Yeah.
That probably don't even exist anymore.
No, probably not. Probably not. Like I know my favorite pizza place doesn't exist any longer. It was kind of a bummer. I mean, outside of like the kind of the bigger names, you know. But like the ones that were just like in your hood pizza spots, you know, like there was a pretty good one near me and I liked it, and I went back there one time and was like, nope, it's not there anymore. Fuck it. So yeah. Never, don't need it ever again. Yeah. So where did you live whenever you lived there? You live on Manhattan or do you live in Brooklyn?
When I first moved there, I lived near Gramercy Park on like 13th or no, sorry. It was 18th and 3rd Avenue.
Wow.
And then, when I moved back, I lived on the Lower East Side on Rivington and Suffolk, but it was like pre-gentrification. So it was like when it was all Cubans and no, like there was Cubans and homeless people. There was no one. Like now when you go there, it's Soho. It's crazy. I like don't recognize it. All the buildings are gone. Like all of the kind of dodgy, like old warehouse, none of that's there anymore. It's like really a different place.
I haven't been there. I just don't know anything about it. It's weird. I just don't. I mean, like I think in 14, I went with my wife's family and my wife. And then I was like, and on that trip, I was like, I don't ever need to come. I can't. I just don't. I think it's over. I think I'm just done with my
life. I love New York for like 2 to 3 days, and then I'm really happy to leave. Like, I like going. I like a really good night out. I love to dance. I want to have a meal, a good meal, see a few friends, and then I'm like out. I'm done. I'm like, I'm ready to leave. I don't want the pee, the subway, the pee. Like, I'm ready.
I know exactly what you mean. It's kind of weird how that works out at some point, and just kind of like, yeah. But I think whenever I, you know, when I think back to the times when I lived there, it was super inspiring though, because there were so many things that you want to, you know, like problems you want to solve or things you want to recreate or any of this kind of stuff. When you're there, it's like it does kind of open up a whole lot in your brain, you know, and make your brain want to do stuff.
So I loved living there when I did, and it was great to be like a broke, starving artist and having this really amazing group of peers that I don't think I would have ever had outside of that place. So in that regard, it was amazing. But
yeah,
very happy to have left.
So when you were in the I-beam class, were you the only female in your class?
Aya Badir was also with me, and she founded a company afterwards called Little Bits, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think she sold it to Mattel or something.
Oh, wow.
But she was Lebanese, and she was amazing. Jessica Banks was also in my kind of cohort.
Okay.
And she had a studio called Rock Paper Robot, I think. And she does this kind of these robotic works. They'd both been at MIT. I think they'd both studied robotics, and they kind of came in under this like creative robotic usage thing.
Okay.
And then the rest of it was guys. So
yeah, because I think because everything that you've mentioned to me, all the people that you had mentioned previous throughout the entire episode actually were all like guys that you'd worked with there in that place.
I think like 95% of my friends are guys, and it's always been that way my whole life. I have really good girlfriends I adore, but most of them are dudes, and I've never really understood why that is.
Most of your girlfriends are dudes. Got it.
Well, some of them were dudes, but they're not anymore. And then I've got, you know, I have a whole like rainbow of friends from all over. So, yeah.
No, I mean, I got it. It was just interesting to me that it was like, you know, in your group, as you were talking about it, it was like, wow, that's interesting that there's just not any other things, you know, women in your group there that have, you know, that have kind of, that you were talking about throughout all of that. Do you know Heather Dewey Hagborg?
Do you know? Yeah, we talk all the time.
Okay. You know, she did a show in I had a place in Long Island City way back in, from 2005 to 13. Well, I was a part of this group, and she did an exhibition in our space there where she built a vitrine, and she put these robots that chased each other around. Some were attracted to light, some were afraid of light, and some had lights, some, you know, did. And there was this, and it was constantly, it was like this kind of weird thing, and none of them ever really got each other, you know. And she used to be with this guy called Tom Dexter. I don't know if you knew Tom or not, but Tom was doing these like really great film loop pieces during that same period. And my question on this was Heather an I-beam person or not? I can't remember.
I think she might have been an I-beam after me, and I think she might have gone to ITP also. I'm actually trying to remember how I met her, because we're pretty good friends, and we talk all the time, and I'm trying to remember actually now where she came into my life, because I've known her for so long. I think she was maybe an artist in residence.
That's possible. Yeah, makes sense to me. Yeah, she got an opera going. She's doing an opera.
Yeah, it's in San Francisco. It actually opened, I think, last week, because I just sent her a message about it.
Me too. I did the same thing. I was like, come hang out. I haven't seen her in a bunch of years. I think the last time I saw her, I was in New York, like, and maybe it was in 2012 or something.
We have a signal. Like, there's a few female artists, I'll be specific. We have a signal group together, and so we have these like signal calls where we video in and talk to each other once in a while.
Oh,
like,
that's every, awesome.
She's one of the women in the group, but I adore her. I think she's brilliant. She's always doing really good work. So
yeah. So we've got about 5 minutes. I know you're up against it because you've got to get off, and I'm up against it because I got to go meet some people to go dinner. So I'm going to ask you this: if you could collaborate with one person at any time period, from any time period,
okay,
who would it be and why? Doesn't have to be an artist either.
Oh wow. I think, I mean, the first person that came to mind when you said that was Dwayne Michaels. He's a photographer. I don't even know if he's alive anymore, but he was one of the first people whose work that I came across where he's a photographer, does black and white, and he does usually triptychs, diptychs of these really interesting kind of series of pieces where he, like, it's a static image, but it shows motion.
Wow.
And I've never seen these and thinking, like, wow, there's people that can, like, show motion and staticness. And I thought it was really poetic. And that's probably the first person that came to mind when you said, like, anyone. I'm sure there's a billion people, though, that yeah. I would love to collaborate with.
So while we're on it then, so if you could have only one person cook your meals for the rest of your life, who would that be?
Wow. There's this restaurant on Washington Square that's like a farm to table place. And the guy that cooks there, I wish I could remember it. It's in New York. It's like, I think it's called Blue Farm or Blue Table or something. The guy that cooks there is absolutely, like, every time I eat there, I'm just like, this is,
it's heaven this for is you. What
heaven is like.
Did you know Mama's?
No.
On the Lower East Side back in the beginning of the 2000s-ish. It was
was this the place that had this, like, amazing these amazing puddings?
Maybe. I just think of it as having, like, the fried chicken and, like, greens and stuff like this that was down there. Well, Michael,
it was on A Street, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I totally know this place.
Yeah. So Michael, he moved here and opened up a place called MJ's Food Shop. And now he's cooking over at another place called Pills over here. He'd be my guy. He'd be the one.
Yeah. I think this place, okay, so I looked it up. It's called Blue Hill. It's on Washington Square, New York City. It's a farm-to-table place. It's been there forever. But the head chef, if he's still there, he cooks absolutely amazing. It's, like, amazing, just amazing. I would have him cook for me forever.
Well, I think you know who your first who the first, like, sponsor of Dinner Dow should be.
Yeah, not a bad idea. I did propose to him once over a apple pie, so I have to keep a low profile.
and is he the father of your children?
No, I think that one of the sous chefs came out and said, like, he can't marry you until you've gone out at least on a date. And then I was like, that's it, I'm done. Like, I can die now. I'm so embarrassed.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hey, Addie, this has been great. I'm gonna let you go so you can do your thing.
Yeah, thanks so much.
I really appreciate having you on. It was a lot of fun. And I can't wait till we get to have our next dinner together and our time together.
Yeah, wonderful. Hopefully I'll see you in Venice or wherever the crew is meeting for our next one.
So I was planning on going to Venice, but I think I'm going to have to skip, unfortunately. But we'll see. I'm still not 100%. Well, yeah, we'll see.
Save a seat for you, so.
Thanks. Hey, everybody, thank you very much for listening. This has been Arbitrarily Deterministic on KeithFM.com. I forgot to tell you, if you like the show, there's a yellow donate button. You can also donate Tez or tokens to idontlikepodcasts.tez, or you can just send me ETH to kenconsumer.eth. Thanks very much.